The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And an interesting program, and we'll start that in just a minute, but do note that we're using the 60-minute format, so watch your time, and if you do want to get an email in or a phone call in to talk to our guest today, Dr. Ken Davidian, plan it so that you don't call in or send an email in after we're already off air. So remember, we're heading for the 60-minute format today. Our phone number is 1-866-687-7223. It's toll-free for those of you in the States and that have toll-free calling to the States. Again, 1-866-687-7223. You can also get through to us with email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and by posting messages on our blog, which is at thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. So click on the first program, that is the program with Dr. Ken Davidian, and open that page up. That is our blog and archive page, but down at the bottom you can post comments. And as soon as you post your comment and hit send or post, I forget what the wording is, I'll get the message and can bring it up on air. Remember, you do not have to be logged in to discuss or any of the social media accounts to post a comment. You can do so as a guest. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Note that our website newsletter is there on the upper right side, and you can check out all of the programming for this week, and we're almost through this week, plus what we have planned for the future in the coming period. We're almost through with February and going into the balance of first quarter 2019. So you can check all of that out, and the newsletter is posted current and fresh once the Sunday program is completed. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our site or easily download stores. Don't forget we have a store in the upper left menu under support. And then there's also the very important button of listen live. This is information you can share with people as it tells you how to listen to live programs, how to listen to compressed MP3 archives on our website, as well as podcasts. And that includes the Alexa server. And Alexa has the TuneIn program, which plays Alexa files embedded on our website. So if you have any questions about any of these methods for listening, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can also use the guest search tool, upper right side of our homepage. And this lists all the programs that we have done and the names of the guests in a very, very short description of the program in chronological order, going back to 2001. The most current shows are on top, so it starts out with the most current, like today's program will be there. And then all the way down at the end goes back to 2001. So if you want to see if your favorite guest has ever been on the show, or what dates he or she was on the show, or you want to get a feel for programming, this is a great quick way to do that. Again, that is the guest search tool, and it's over on the right upper side of our homepage above the Space Show website newsletter. So do check it out. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you are free to download all of our programs and share them. It is easier, of course, to just send URLs around. And we're podcasting, and we're in iTunes and a host of other places. And if you have any questions about podcasting or problems with however you're trying to listen to a podcast, please email me again at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit listener-supported program. Our nonprofit parent is onegiantleapfoundation.org. You'll find supporting the Space Show information on our homepage over center right. And without your support, we won't be able to bring you the kind of programming we do, and we may eventually disappear. We are 100% listener-supported. So remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. We're a public benefit corporation in California. And we look forward to your support. And certainly, we hope we earn it. If you have any questions, email me at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's probably the easiest way to get through to me. And today we have, well, let me say one more thing. We have sponsors. All of you know that. Their banner ads go across our homepage, and they can change their message whenever they want. On full-length programs, I read a short sponsor message, and on shorter programs like today, I simply thank our sponsor so that I don't eat into guest talk time. So I do want to thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, MoonWords, the Space Development Org, .org, AIAA, Celestis, and the Space Plan. We do have some openings for sponsorships for 2019, and if you're interested, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that brings me to our program today. I'm very happy to bring back to the program Dr. Ken Davidian. We also congratulate him on having completed and earned his Ph.D. Ken has worked for the FAA's Office of Commercial Space, or AST, in Washington, D.C. You're going on 11 years now, right, Ken?
Yeah, I'm starting my, I think I just finished my 10th year or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and he's currently the AST Director of Research and Program Manager for the FAA's Center of Excellence for Commercial Space Transportation. He has a lot of other credentials. As I said, he just completed his Ph.D. in Business Administration from the University of Cape Town. His thesis focused on innovation management and understanding the processes of emerging and evolving markets, something we talk about all the time on the Space Show, because certainly the new space part of commercial space is an emerging and evolving commercial space market. I suggest you read Ken's full bio. It is up on our website, and we would like to talk to him. And welcome back to the show, Ken. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy 2019 to you and all your listeners. I'm doing great, a little bit of a rough throat, but it's sunny for now here in Washington, D.C., and so things are going really well, and I'm really, really happy to be here again. I can't imagine. I looked at the guest list here, and I've been on your show a number of times. I didn't realize I'd been on so many times, so thank you for having me back, David.
Are you enjoying your furlough?
Oh, yes, I am furloughed. I am not working right now. I am, you know, it's sort of stir crazy. I kind of want to get to work, and I'm kind of trying to do, you know, we're not allowed to do certain activities. We're not allowed to work. We had to put a certain out-of-office message on our voicemail and our email, but I'm doing like individual research at home, some of the stuff that's continuation of my PhD stuff, all the postdoc stuff. I'm starting to work on some of that, and so I'm keeping myself busy.
Well, hopefully you and others will be able to go back to work soon, but that's beyond the Space Show's purvey of control and influence. So enjoy, and hope you get back soon. So you have now completed your PhD. When I talked about the focus of your dissertation in emerging markets and evolving markets, did you actually focus on space, and did your graduate school know anything about space, or were you teaching them at the same time they were teaching you?
Yeah, so to answer that question, yeah, absolutely. I was teaching them about space. And it's funny, something I saw with the first-year PhD cadre in my year, and then I went back every year and I saw the group of students that were first years for my second and my third year. And it's funny how every student comes in there, and I did the same thing, saying, I want to study the space industry and how it, you know, how it's evolving and how to do that in a better way. And everybody comes in with an idea or an industry or a subject they love, and they want to study it. But when you're doing your PhD, you know, you're supposed to make a theoretical contribution. And the theoretical contribution has got to be to whatever the management study is, or strategic study is, or in this case, I did organization theory. So space becomes the research context of the actual theoretical contribution. So there's kind of two parts to this research. One is the space part, which is super interesting to me, but wasn't, you know, like you said, nobody in the school really cared about space. You know, there, as you mentioned, I went to school in South Africa. They were the beginning of their 3-year drought when I got there. You know, there's a lot of social inequality and all that sort of stuff going on in South Africa. So they're, you know, focused on many other things and not necessarily an emerging space industry. But how to build an industry and what needs to be done to help industries evolve and emerge at an accelerated rate rather than letting it happen at some slower rate. Those are very interesting topics to almost any economy, and definitely to South Africa, to Zimbabwe, and the other Mozambique, the other surrounding economies in Southern Africa. So they were interested in that. So, yes, as I was teaching them about space and in some cases teaching them about some of the industrial theory, organization theory that I was looking at, they were also, I was teaching them and they were teaching me at the same time.
Is business theory and education from a South African perspective different than what we're doing in this country and that applies to the commercial space companies, the entrepreneurs, the startups, as well as NASA and the more traditional, larger, long-standing aerospace industry? Is there a difference?
So there's, I would say, again, the space context is it's just a context for the theoretical discussion or the discussion of is there a difference of sort of business education or management education in South Africa or in Africa versus in Western Europe or in the United States? And the answer is yes. And so you're getting into a whole discussion about academic colonialism and, you know, trying to find their own identity, the African management academics trying to find their own identity, just in the same way that China is going through this academic renaissance. They're blending in with the Western academic kind of norms and methods, but they're sort of creating their own. And this, you know, I was reading about this morning. The same industries in different countries will evolve differently because of culture and because of the institutions. And this is part of what went into the research, was you can't look at an economy or at an industry as a purely economic entity, because there are social forces at work that do totally direct the way it emerges and the way it evolves. And so there are absolutely going to be differences in a culture by culture, nation by nation, you know, or continent by continent context. So that was part of the complexity or the intricacy of the theory, was going beyond just technology and finance, but including institutions and culture to some extent into the theoretical construct.
So give us sort of a summary of what you worked on and how you treated the commercial space business, the startups, the emerging and evolving part of it. I often say the emerging part of commercial space, because, you know, there's been commercial space in this country since day one, since we don't really have nationalized industry. Give us a sort of an idea of what you wrote about, what you researched, what you accomplished.
Yeah, sure. No, that's exactly That's good. So, and in fact, I'll send you a link, David, that has got an executive summary up on my Commercial Space Wiki, a two-page summary of my dissertation. Basically, what it says is we wanted to look at the industry as a social system, so looking at, yes, proprietary functions like technologies and testing and marketing, market creation. We wanted to look at proprietary functions. We wanted to look at the resources that were available, including financial resources, but also human capital and knowledge resources, so scientific and technological knowledge that had been developed. And then into those two things, add a third component, which was institutional arrangements. So you're talking about norms and rules and regulations, but also we're talking about standards, and we're talking about different types of licensing practices and endorsements. So you start looking at all those different types of activities and how they start to interrelate. So now for my research, the industry context I chose was the human suborbital space transportation industry. Like you said, there have been, you know, there are many sectors of commercial space. Commercial space is not one thing. So, you know, Earth to orbit, you know, cargo transportation, Earth to orbit human, suborbital, they're all different major major segments of just transportation. You've got remote sensing satellites, you've got communication satellites, so you've got all these major sectors as well. So when we talk about commercial space, we've got to talk about specific sectors and segments, and so I really zeroed in on human suborbital. And by doing that, and part of the fun parts of a PhD is narrowing your focus. You can't be too broad. So I focused on human suborbital specifically, and by doing that, I limited my scope to companies or firms that have actually built or started building hardware. And so that included just five companies in human suborbital. It had Scaled Composites. It had Rocket Plane, because they had started building hardware. It had Blue Origin. It had Virgin Galactic, and it had X-Corp. And so those were the five companies I focused on, looked at how they emerged, how they, you know, got, you know, when they went and got permits and licenses, and when they were getting different investment funding from whether it's governments or, you know, VCs or different state governments. And so, you know, I mapped that all out to show sort of an evolution of the industry. And it goes up to the current day, 2018 or so, but it starts back in the mid-50s, because that's when government research started investigating technologies that fed into the suborbital transportation industry.
You have an email question already, and Bill is in Denver, Colorado, and he said, on your list of five, there are at least two companies that are no longer around, probably as a result of really bad management. That's my guess, although I'm not on the inside of either one of them. How different was the studying of companies that have failed versus the others that are still plugging along and may actually accomplish goals?
That's a great observation, and that was something that really, really, you know, to me, I was, you know, I tend to be somebody who votes for the underdog, and I really, really wanted to see X-Corp succeed, because they'd gotten so far, they were making great progress, and when they finally did not succeed, that was heart-crushing, because what it told us was that the only companies that are making it in this industry, in this segment, are the ones that are getting hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, not those that are getting tens of millions of dollars. And we sort of have this vision or this rosy, optimistic, kind of idea that, you know, there's going to be a group of folks working in their garage, and they're going to be able to develop these vehicles, and we're going to be able to, you know, have them make a major contribution to the industry. And really, we haven't seen that at all. The companies that were working on a shoestring, which was basically Rocket Plane and X-Corp, they both dropped out of the running. Scaled Composite, granted, you know, the original Paul Allen investment to Burt Rutan was on the order of $30 million, you know, the tens of millions of dollars range. But I mean, the creation of the spaceship company, you know, getting together with Virgin, you know, they had a big support system there that Rocket Plane and X-Corp did not have. So they were able to draw on a huge knowledge and experience base that the other companies didn't. So
let me ask you a question, because, again, I'm on the outside looking in. I'm not close to either Rocket Plane or X-Corp, despite having put their people on the show all the time. I suspect that you could have given them many, many more millions, and they would have still failed because their management wasn't capable of taking them to where they needed to go, whereas those that are still in the game, not only can they access a lot more capital, but they have a lot more human capital at their disposal and a lot more competent human capital. Am I assuming something not in fact and erroneous, or is there any merit at all to what I personally think?
I don't know. You know, I know all the characters, you know, all the personalities that we're talking about here. And I'm not necessarily in a great position to judge whether they're good managers or bad managers, and I wasn't on the inside of the companies. I would say that, A, in any business, there's a huge element of luck that's involved, you know, and so you could have a great manager within a company, but then not able to succeed because the chips don't fall their way. But at the same time, both the companies, Rocket Plane and X-Corp, their activities had to be, their internal company goals had to be redirected at certain times to chase the money, because they were in survival mode. And in fact, you know, this is one of the major differences between neoclassic economics and, you know, business and management, and the sociological perspective, the sociology perspective is that in neoclassic economics, you've got self-interest of an individual that's pursuing, you know, maximizing profit, you know, the profit-maximizing, you know, firm kind of assumption.
Right.
Whereas in sociology, instead of self-interest, it's survival, which is really what is the driving aspect. And you talk to any entrepreneur in any industry, and they'll tell you that it is a fight for survival, especially in the early days of establishing the company. They'll talk about these things called liabilities of newness. In the business world, new companies have a liability of newness, lack of resources, lack of reputation, and then you throw in lack of an established technology in an emerging industry, and you've got this triad of hurdles that these companies have to get over, and it's very, very hard. So to help keep their companies survive, both Rocket Plane and X-Corp had to divert their company's activities to different goals. In Rocket Plane's case, they went to the COTS program. They bid on and won the COTS program in the first round, and then they were later, you know, expelled because they couldn't meet their financial milestones. And X-Corp ended up taking on these propulsion contracts that, you know, were diverting resources and attention from the vehicle development. So both these companies had to divert their attention, pursue sort of tangential but not direct goals of the company. And that, you know, that just sort of, you know, they did that to maintain survivability. And it just didn't work for them. And like you said, maybe they didn't have access to the huge pool of capital, human capital that they needed. And so it was just a tough way to go. If they had more resources, they could have probably had a second group of individuals, you know, that would be focused on this alternative goal. You know, one of the hard parts in doing the research, when you start looking at the money, especially for like Blue Origin, you see one pot of gold. Jeff Bezos says he's going to sell $1 billion of Amazon stock a year, and that's going to go into Blue Origin. Well, I couldn't tell what fraction of that, of his investments, and at first it was $500 million, I couldn't tell what fraction of that was going into the suborbital part of his company versus the other aspects of his company. So he had the resources to be able to do that. When you're in a resource-rich environment, then, you know, you're not going to be constrained, and you can, you know, ramp up and do a lot of things that if you're in a resource, you know, poor environment, you're going to be really constrained, and you're going to make decisions that aren't necessarily the best financially, which puts you in more trouble, but they're there to maximize your chances at survivability.
Yeah, so I I at least partially agree with you. And if you look at the terrestrial case going on right now with Sears, so their management, again, in my opinion, really missed the boat on how to be competitive in retail in recent years, mostly because of what was happening with Amazon and online. They totally missed it. And by the time that lethargic, inept management stuck in old ways realized it, they're in survival mode, which is what you talked about.
Right.
So now they divert resources to closing stores, trying to find which stores can maximize an old-fashioned retail brick-and-mortar return on investment, which is labor-intensive and property tax-intensive and, you know, the whole thing. And they still can't muster resources to effectively compete in what retail has become through Walmart, through Costco, through online thing. And now, of course, they're into liquidation because they could never figure it out. So, yes, they had a problem once they got into survival mode that they couldn't get out of, but it was their management that totally missed what was happening in retail so that they no longer became competitive.
Yeah, and that's a little bit, you're absolutely right. It's a little bit, the similarities are a little strained there, just because with the human suborbital industry, you're talking about starting an industry that there's no
history about or anything. Yeah.
No companies have entered the market yet.
Right.
I mean, every company is in what they call pre-production mode. They're doing internal R&D. Nobody, you know, Virgin has pre-sold tickets, reservations for future flights, but nobody has delivered a good or a service for compensation yet. And so everything is pre-production. This market has not, there are zero entrants into this market as of today. With Sears, of course, they're going through a major upheaval. There's a major disruption. And the problem there is you have managers that have risen through the ranks of a company, and because they've made great decisions, they've had good performance, and they've got a certain set of tools that they have in their management toolkit, and they've used those tools in the past, and they've been successful. Now along comes this new business model, this new disruptive innovation that they haven't seen before, nobody has, and they try to deal with it using their old set of tools, but it turns out, and this is textbook Clayton Christensen, it turns out that everything that they want to do and what they've done in the past to be successful is the absolute wrong thing, you know, to be doing now. They need to be looking at a whole different toolkit, a whole different set of methodologies to deal with this. And like you said, by the time they sort of are aware of how much their customers are being drained or how much the technology is bypassing them and passing them up, they're flailing, it's too late, and they get into this crisis mode. So
yeah, and that's the same that you're describing once
right.
for X-Core and Rocket Plane as well.
Although
a different magnitude.
Right.
So where does this all lead in your studies? Do you get to predict success stories? Are you picking winners?
Okay, so absolutely not. So what the theoretical contribution was, and the reason I went through, you know, you've heard of Hobby Space and Clark Lindsay's blog and
right, uh-huh.
Parabolic Arc and Alluria Report. So I scoured all those. Those are great aggregator sites for the activities and the everyday events going on in, you know, non-governmental space, commercial space, you know, all the different sectors and segments. And so I went through there, and I was able to put a lot of that, all of that data into a database, do some searches to find the suborbital-related entries, things for spaceports and things for the different companies. And then I started, you know, getting citations for all of those, and I started mapping it out. So I mentioned before these three major segments or sectors or infrastructure elements that we use to characterize the industry, the institutional arrangements, the resource endowments, and the proprietary functions. So I mapped all these different events onto those different those three major elements and those sub-elements and sub-sub-elements. And so I ended up with this historic map, and from that I sort of came up with a process map of what's going on for that leads to industry emergence. And so this is a form of research called process the process approach versus the variance approach. Variance approach research is very good for taking a model that exists and then getting in a bunch of data to test whether or not there are correlations that actually do exist according to the hypotheses of the model. And that's after the model's been created. What I did was I was taking an existing model and extending it. And so it was more qualitative research. It was more in-depth and deep understanding of the material. So from that, I've come up with this process map of how industries evolve based on that framework, those industry infrastructure elements. And then what I did was I actually threw in a part about the prizes. How did the influence of the X Prize affect the development of all those different industry infrastructure elements? And, you know, where was it moderating or mediating the phenomenon of industry emergence? So because the X Prize was such a major event, when you look at the history event timeline, there's some stuff going on prior to XPRIZE, but once XPRIZE happens, things just, you know, there are tons of events that happen. A lot of investment, a lot of testing, so that was a major event there. So we put the impact of the prize in there, and so I came up with a phenomenological or a process diagram for industry development, and that was the theoretical approach or the theoretical contribution. But what I've done since then is try to map the events against an innovation process model. And so there are different models of how innovations evolve and the different steps of innovation. So I took one which is fairly complex. It's got 12 steps. And I mapped the industry evolution events against those 12 steps. And by looking at that, you can make some educated guesses of what policies could be done or what regulations could be changed to help accumulate more resources in certain infrastructure elements where they might be lacking or where you might want to avoid the government getting involved where it might impede industry emergence. So that's what we call the operationalization of the theory, is to map it against this innovation process model and then try to infer, you know, some semi-intelligent policy and regulatory recommendations.
And did you come up with recommendations? What are they?
So I have not necessarily come up with recommendations. Just at the highest level, there is a total lack of technology standard work going on. And there's been some attempts at it. CSF, Commercial Spaceflight Federation, has done a little bit with this. And more recently, through cooperation with the Commercial Space Transportation Advisory Committee to the FAA and CSF, they're working with the ASTM International folks to help to have technology standard subgroups just work together and start developing things. And that's a critical activity, because there really is not a lot of activity that's been done in technology standards. And technology standards are super important, and they're going to help the evolution or the emergence eventually of the dominant design of the industry. Right now, we don't know if the dominant design of the industry is going to be a vertical rocket that goes up with a capsule that pops off, or a horizontal takeoff, you know, mothership, you know, with a little spaceship underneath that gets dropped at altitude and goes up and then glides home. So we don't know which one of those are going to become the dominant design. I mean, we're thinking ahead two or three decades, where once a market is proven and once one of these companies goes out there and starts selling tickets a go-go, you're going to have other companies jumping in and copying that same architecture. And so then there's going to become this de facto dominant design. Then you're going to really start getting technology standards that evolve and emerge that are specific to that design. Because right now, the technology standard process is politically charged. Everybody's in there trying to make sure that their design and their interests are being well served by the standards. And right now, there's just way too much uncertainty.
But the vehicles are pretty radically different, say, you know, Virgin versus Blue, for example.
Right.
If we just look at those, you know, there's no uniformity there. Does there need to be, or isn't the emerging market capable of supporting different concepts for different kinds of vehicles?
Yeah, we just don't know. And it's going to, you know, right now we're assuming that there's going to be a non-governmental market for this stuff. And there, I really hope there is, because I really want to fly. I can't do it at $200 or $250 or $300,000 a ticket. So I'm really hoping that there's a non-governmental market to this mark for this segment, so that ultimately there'll be more producers, suppliers, and there'll be more flights and all that sort of stuff. We just don't know yet. And part of the issue is not an issue, but part of the challenge is that we tend to think, oh, 3-4 years from now there'll be this or there'll be that. And really, we should be talking in decades, which is, it's disappointing for me, because I really want this thing to happen. When I look at my history of emergence chart, I mean, it's decades. I've got 5 or 6 decades on this thing. And we're just at the point we are right now. And this is part of the problem, is that if you want industries to emerge, let's say the military wants certain capability, 10 flights and 10 suborbital flights in 10 days or something. If you want industry to emerge, you can't wait for the market necessarily to find what capabilities will sell and then let the technology evolve over time, because it can take decades and decades and decades. So with the DARPA launch challenge, for example, they're really trying to stimulate a capability which may or may not have market applicability. There might be no non-governmental demand for this. We don't know. I mean, they're hoping there is, but they're trying to stimulate that in a couple of years' time, and I think normally something like that would take a couple decades.
But their stimulation money and support, do you show that it can radically alter the timeline for development? Can it short-circuit that time of needing decades, and by how much?
So that's a really good question. Now, I did not look at the small satellite launch industry. So one of the things I want to do personally or through my job or however is I want to stimulate similar research to what I've done but for other industry segments. So I've done it for human suborbital. You know, think of any other space transportation segment, and I think we need to do the same sort of stuff, high-altitude balloons, even spaceports, but the small satellite launchers. We could be doing this type of research for that, if nothing else, than to have an accurate historical record of how the industry is emerging, because a lot of research, especially in business, is weak in that it does not have a comprehensive record of the early days of a given history. So one of the exceptions to that is the automobile industry, where there are great records that have been kept. So they can talk about the 1,500 different companies that, were starting up in the late 1800s, early 1900s, trying to enter the automobile market. But it would be a big job to do that for the Earth-to-orbit, manned or even cargo vehicles. Because it does, it started 50, 60 years ago with all the government work, and there was a lot of things that went into it. So it would be very detailed, very complex. But with other segments like high-altitude balloons or small satellite launchers, we could really get a good detailed look at how the industry is emerging, because we're living it right now. And so that's kind of exciting. So in terms of how fast will it speed up the technology development or adoption by, having the government invest more money today, I don't have an answer for that, but it's obviously they're setting a goal and the companies are pursuing it. But this gets back to your original question, David. Why not just nationalize the industry then? If you're having companies perform, technology development to meet government goals uniquely, only government goals, there's no non-governmental demand for this goal. If you're doing that, why not just make it a government company?
Well, I could give you a dozen reasons why not, but what are the academic or at least the theoretical reasons not to do that or to do it, however the chips fall?
Well, to do it is, obviously to speed things up. And this is where the cultural aspects come into it. America is got many, many tales about basically how the rugged individualism, the Protestant work ethic, all this has combined to lead to the large organization, multi-divisional corporate form. I mean, when during the mid-1800s, 1850s and beyond, when railroads, coal, were these big industries were developing, there was huge geographical distances that needed to be crossed. There was huge amounts of money that had to come in to support the financial, the infrastructure development. And so that led to a certain kind of you know, development or creation of certain kinds of companies that ultimately led to managers of distant, you know, organizations, you know, or subunits of an organization far, far away. So basically, the a lot of the effort went to how to control managers and evaluate their performance that are far, far away. So they've got the control of a company is very decentralized in our country, and the performance of managers was being evaluated by the stock market. And so by using that was the way that finances and the capital markets were being monitored was through stock prices and whatnot. Whereas in other countries, things are more centralized. Companies have direct relationships with banks. They have longer-term perspectives. So they have the companies themselves then have longer-term perspectives, and they stayed more centralized. And I'm thinking of Germany right now. But it's just interesting. I mean, I don't think anybody in the U.S., and one of the unique things about the U.S. is that we don't have many government-controlled enterprises, you know, state-owned enterprises, and especially in, you know, the space industry, none of them are state-owned. But when a company is privately owned but only has the government as a customer, and the government is setting the goals and the government is controlling critical resources, I mean, how different is it?
Well, if the government owned it, I guess the theory would be the citizens were benefiting, and when the privates are doing it and the government's the only customer, that the stockholders share in that, including pension plans and retirement plans and things like that, assuming they're successful. I would imagine the private sector is more risky than the government unless government decides to get out of the business or cancel what they're doing.
And those are totally valid, and I think those are exactly my assumptions, too. One of the things I found out was that, you know, you start talking about the idea that smaller companies are more innovative than bigger companies, and there's a bunch of arguments for and against that. Schumpeter himself was arguing against that, saying that smaller companies didn't have the resources that big companies did, so they would not be able to take the risks or would not be able to innovate the way that big companies could. So Schumpeter actually argued that larger companies could be more innovative. And I think the research shows that smaller companies can be more innovative because there's less organizational inertia they have to overcome. Where was I going with that? Anyways, it's an interesting thing to look at, and I know what I was going to say. The Boeing company is a very, very innovative company. Lockheed Martin is very, very innovative. It's just that Boeing Space and Defense is one division of big Boeing. So they might come up with great ideas, but then they have to sell those ideas at the higher level in their organization. And sometimes they can't succeed doing that. They don't succeed in doing that. Yeah.
No, they don't. So where does all of this take us if we want to better understand your target industry, which is human suborbital flight? What are our takeaways? And if people from Virgin or Blue are reading your work or listening to what you have to say, what are their takeaways?
No, that's a great question. And you know, I've talked to folks from both companies, and you know, sometimes I think I'm a little too close to the nitty-gritty, and I need to step back. And it's been about a year since I submitted my final dissertation for evaluation, so step back and look at it. I think one of the major takeaways is that looking at the social aspect of this, one of the major contributors and one of the major things that the companies are doing is right now they're building legitimacy. In the social sciences, legitimacy is kind of one of the major attributes that you're always trying to build. And I remember sitting in a meeting with the DARPA guys when they were talking about the launch challenge. They were talking about how, you know, making it a DARPA challenge would provide legitimacy, and making the companies get FAA, you know, licenses adds legitimacy. So all these things are contributors to legitimacy, and there's different types of legitimacy, and we're definitely in need of doing things that legitimize this function to the average American public. So making suborbital space transportation a normal thing, a quote-unquote normal thing, it's a very hard thing to do, and a lot of resources have got to be spent on it.
What does this tell us for those of us on the outside wanting to see all of this happen? And how many years have we been waiting for human suborbital spaceflight? I mean, I wrote about it in my dissertation in 2001 and thought it was maybe a year to the proverbial 2 years away, and, you know, it's still not here. So what does this tell us? I mean, we've obviously been missing the timeline, at least in the advocate community. We've been missing the timeline. Maybe management was more realistic, though they didn't publicize it. Give us some help here.
Yeah, no, that's, again, like I said before, we need to think in terms of decades and not years, because that just seems, I mean, you think about XPRIZE, right?
Right.
It was won in 2004. And here we're coming up to the 2020s next year, and, you know, I think finally we're going to start seeing the initial, you know, launches of you know, humans into suborbital space for tourism purposes, but it's going to be another 4 or 5 years before all the kinks are worked out of the systems. Hopefully no major accidents happen. And so it's going to be a while, and it'll be 2 decades from the time that XPRIZE is won to the time that the industry is taking off, is, you know, really getting some adoption by consumers. So I think thinking in decades is kind of the way to go, or at least one way to adjust our expectations. We just need to think in longer term, because this stuff is hard. We're talking about real hardware, and whenever you start going through design iteration after design iteration, since we are in a time of technological uncertainty, it's just going to take a lot of time. So I think that's one of the major takeaways.
Here's another question for you. Alice is in Seattle, and she says, I'm in the finance world. I work in an investment house. I don't want to say which one. But we don't think in terms of investments decades out. So what do you think would happen to the efforts of these new space companies, including the ones that seem to be well-funded, if they went to their investors and said, invest today and maybe we'll be able to start business and have some cash flow and do something in 2 decades? That would never sell, in my opinion. So there, in America at least, is an incentive to announce a very short timeline to success.
That's right. And we saw a couple times, you know, there was a number of announcements by Virgin Galactic saying that, you know, the first flights are going to be so many months away or years away than months away. And then the accident happened at the end of 2014. And so things have been delayed. Richard Branson, after the most recent flight, you know, is getting a little optimistic again. And I hope he's right, 100%. But you're right, the finance world currently typically doesn't think short term. So look at the, again, in suborbital world. Jeff Bezos is absolutely playing the long game. He needs money from nobody. He's totally self-financed. When you look at the overall network of resources or network of capabilities that create an entire industry, and sometimes we refer to this as tiers, the industry tiers, you know, tier one, tier two, tier three. I've drawn this up as more of a series of hexagons, more like a honeycomb. It looks like more like a playing board of a strategy game, where you've got, again, all the raw materials, all the infrastructure, all the subsystems, vehicles and equipment. When you look at the different capabilities that Jeff Bezos has, he's got his own spaceport. He's got his own finance and capital. He needs nobody's money, so he can play the long game. And you're talking about somebody who's fishing, you know, F1 rocket engines out of the ocean floor and refurbishing. He's building a 10,000-year clock in the center of a mountain. You know, this is a guy that is thinking long term. When you look at Virgin Galactic, Virgin Group gave it $100 million to kick off at the start of the company, but since then you're talking about UAE coming in with Abar Investments, investing $100 million, $300 million. And so UAE is a country where they've got this 100-year plan, and they're starting to build a Mars community out in the desert to test technologies for ultimate Martian, you know, habitation. So again, they're thinking longer term. And so you're absolutely right. the current finance world doesn't work to the shorter term return horizons, and that's why capital is such a big deal. Now, Secretary Ross of the Commerce Department recently talked about how it's interesting to see some major banks having done some studies about commercial space and looking at it as an investment, and that's absolutely true. And what's good about that is we do need new pools of capital. We need major pools of capital that will come in and start, you know, providing more resources for more companies to get started up. And once you start doing that, especially with those older, larger, established institutions, then it's going to increase the level of visibility, legitimacy to other companies and investors, and then they'll start doing it as well. Now, as we know, the financiers and VCs and whatnot can be sort of followers, smart followers, and so a bunch of people will jump in, something will go wrong, and then a bunch of people will jump out. So it's a little more cyclic. I'm glad that the visibility that SpaceX is providing and that Blue Origin is providing at the larger scale, and especially the remote sensing satellites, the small satellites, because that's where a lot of the investment is going these days, right, is in the small sat. So I'm glad that's creating interest. It's just that there might be a boom and bust kind of cycle to it, but the ones that are succeeding, at least in the suborbital world, are those that are longer-term visionaries.
Another question for you is, Bob is in Atlanta, and he said, Ken, since you're in government and you know more about the people and the policies and the regulatory world, are the regulators, the policymakers, in tune with what you're talking about today on the space show, or is there a huge gap in the thinking of the regulators for these startup and new emerging industries versus reality?
So that's a really good question. Without knowing it, let me say it this way. The actions that have been taken by FAA, the regulators, by NASA, the technology developers, basically, things that Department of Commerce, NOAA, State Department, Defense Department, the things that the government departments have been doing specifically in the emerging space industries, let's say, I think have been very, very beneficial. I mean, they probably, you know, it's not like they went to school, they studied this stuff and said, this is what we need to do. They're going on what makes sense. They're doing what makes sense. And I think they really are doing really good things. I mean, part of the reason for getting the PhD was just to be able to allow my managers to say, listen, we have somebody, he studied this stuff. When we had questions about how to make decisions, we conferred with the academic, the theoretical side of things. But, we took everything else into consideration. We took, individual entrepreneurs' opinions into consideration. We took political factors or technological factors into consideration. And we made a decision with all that input. I am not kidding myself. I don't think that anybody's ever going to take my research, at least in the government, and say we're going to make all our decisions based on this. But I wanted my managers at least to be able to say with a straight face that we listened to the academic perspective. We knew what the theory behind it was. And so given everything, we were able to make the decision we made. So basically give them plausible deniability. And so I think the people in the government right now are doing the right things. I do not see anybody in the government directly and overtly trying to hold the industry back. Yeah, I hate to say it, but we're kind of a bunch of space nuts. Most of us really came up through the space world. We're very high on the accomplishment of space. We take our job seriously, so I can tell you for a fact that the regulators in our office are dead serious about safety, and if somebody comes in wanting to do something that seems unsafe, or they're not providing sufficient information so that our folks can make safety determinations, they'll definitely press them on it. And sometimes that takes more time or is harder than the firms want to be pressed. But everybody in my office that I've talked to, they are totally supportive, and they really want to make this work. And so I think the government, at least in this industry, is kind of on the same side as industry, and we just need to, it's a balancing act, right? We need to balance the government interests, the public interests, and the industry interests all at the same time. And even within those three groups, there can be conflicting goals and conflicting interests. But all three groups have safety as an interest, so we're absolutely doing things that are going to maximize the safety of all the systems.
You have another email from Rachel in Tucson, Arizona. And Rachel says, given what's happening in the industry, the FAA and the AST had an incredibly supportive director who just recently retired, Dr. George Neal. I would meet him at Space Advocate conferences all the time, and you couldn't find anybody more supportive. But he's gone. What's going to happen with the new leader, and is he going to reach out and go to Space Advocate and sort of entrepreneurial commercial space conferences and fill the shoes of Dr. Neal, or is it going to be a different kind of AST?
That's a great question, and I love Tucson, Arizona. I got to live there for a little bit when I worked for a company down there. George Neal was absolutely a great proponent of and supporter of and cheerleader for the emerging commercial space industry. He left last March. Brigadier General Wayne Monteith is going to be succeeding him. He'll be starting at AST the 22nd of January. His official entry on duty date at AST is the 20th, which is a Sunday. 21st is Martin Luther King Day. So his first day in the office will be 22 January of this month, a couple weeks from now. And I do not know the general. I have heard great things about him. And if you go onto the YouTube and you look up, you know, Wayne Monteith and you listen to things he said and that are presented on the web, he has been instrumental in getting, he was the commander of the Eastern Range. And so, the government range at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station that was launching rockets, you know, off the East Coast. So, he was instrumental in getting them to modernize their operations and tempo of launch so that they could get up to 48 launches a year. That was his goal, 48 launches a year. And he was absolutely doing what he could and getting this, talk about, you know, organizational inertia, trying to get the Air Force to change its ways so that they could accommodate the flexibility that comes with, you know, new space players. You know, these new space players don't have 50, 60 years of history of working with government and doing things at a government pace. But, you know, you don't get 21 launches a year like SpaceX did last year, you know, by, you know, going at a government pace necessarily. So Monteith was absolutely supportive of getting more launches through the system, trying to figure out ways to configure the system so that it could deal with that tempo. And this is who we have now coming into AST. So I'm super optimistic. The idea of, you know, there's an idea in management that the person that you hire is being hired to address whatever the major problem is facing that organization at the time. So AST, when we were hiring our deputy associate administrators, we hired three or four in a row there for a while. When we had an issue with human spaceflight operations, we hired astronauts. When we had a problem with Hill, we hired somebody who was a former Hill staffer. And so with General Monteith coming in, you have to think that one of the major issues that the selection committee for this position wanted to resolve was getting commercial launchers, operators into and through the federal range system, and General Monteith is going to be a perfect guy to do that. So we're really excited about him coming in.
Is he an Air Force general?
He is an Air Force Brigadier General. I see. I don't know how many stars he's got on his Brigadier. I have no idea what that means.
I guess you'll get to meet him in a couple of weeks. So
there's going to be a huge learning curve, because FAA is not the same as the Air Force. FAA is not the same as NASA. I mean, one of the reasons I left NASA to go to FAA was to see a different federal agency, and they're very, very different. So in some ways, FAA will be similar to the Air Force. I think it tends to have more of a military kind of mindset than NASA does, but in other ways, it's going to be very different because it is a civilian agency, not a military one.
Randy is in Phoenix, Arizona, and he says, you mentioned a wiki. Do you have your full dissertation, and do you have some of your supplemental research graphs and charts and documents posted where people can see what you're talking about or have access to your research?
Yeah, so if you go to bit.ly, bit.ly/KD for Ken Davidian, KD PhD ES for executive summary. So bit.ly/KD PhD ES. It'll take you to a Davidian's doctorate dissertation executive summary, and it's a wiki page. And at the bottom of that wiki page is a PDF of this executive summary, but also a PDF of the full thesis, and then some other stuff, a little video of me talking about, actually a video of my graduation is in there, because it was really so University of Cape Town, South Africa was a British colony, so it was a British ceremony. I wore this red robe with this bonnet, you know, with this floppy hat and stuff, and you walk up and the vice chancellor of the university taps you on the shoulder, and it was really very ceremonial. So, and then a brief video of me describing the thesis. So all of that's on that wiki page.
How did you choose a Cape Town university?
Everybody asked me that, and it's a great question. So number one, I was looking for... It's a good school, actually. Number one, I was looking for a school where I didn't have to quit my job to get my PhD. I mean, I started my PhD when I was 55. I didn't want to quit my job, and so I needed to find a research-only program, where I didn't have to take 2 years of classes full-time or 4 to 5 years part-time. I think 4 to 5 years of courses before you start the dissertation would have been just a little bit hard for me to deal with. I could see investing 3 to 4 years, but 5 to 6 to 7 years would have been hard to keep up the pace. So number one, I was looking for a place with research only. And there are a number of places in the Southern Hemisphere that offer this, typically Australia and Africa, I guess. But also, there's a couple places, I guess, in Western Europe. The second thing I was looking for was something in the area, my academic area that I wanted to research. At that point, when I started, I was looking at strategic management, business school. So that I was looking for that. Number three, even though there's research that says the school you go to for an engineering degree or the degree in the hard sciences, the school you go to absolutely will determine your starting salary, what kind of how good your first job will be. If you're going to academics, your acceptance rate of paper submissions to journals. But in the social sciences, if you're not going to Harvard or Stanford or Hong Kong or London or INSEAD in Paris, it almost doesn't matter. So I was looking for, like I said, a good school. It turns out University of Cape Town is consistently listed in the top 1, 2, or 3 schools of the entire continent of Africa. It had a research-only program. They did have something in organization theory and strategic management. I was able to find an advisor, which is one of the hardest parts, is finding an academic advisor, especially when you didn't come up through the system. You've got to talk to somebody and talk them into taking you on as a student. So finding the advisor, and then... the fifth reason was, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of Cape Town or have been there, but it is absolutely beautiful. This is an amazingly gorgeous part of the world, and I went there 15 times in 3 years, and I loved every single trip I went there, despite the fact that it's 24 hours on a plane one way, each way. It was absolutely beautiful. And the last reason for Cape Town was its proximity to a wine-growing region. The wines in Cape Town are amazingly good. Back in the mid-1600s, the Danes that had originally did the settlement started bringing French and German wine growers over, and they started these vineyards, and it's just amazing wines that they have. So I was bringing back a lot of wine every time I'd come back from Cape Town. So that's basically why I did it. It is amazing. I just loved the diversity. The people were great. The food was great. The nature was great. The school was great. I just had a blast. I just had such a blast. You know, I've got friends in Namibia, Uganda, and Mozambique, you know, Zimbabwe. It's too much fun.
So when you, if you don't take classes, why did you go over there 14 times?
Well, in fact, the requirement was you only have to go 4 times your first year, and after that you don't have to go anymore. To me, I don't know if you know who Tom Lehrer was. Back in the 60s, Tom Lehrer was a chemistry PhD from Harvard who made his name by playing the piano and doing song parodies. And one of the things that stuck with me on a Tom Lehrer record when I was listening to that when I was growing up was his joke that life is like a sewer. What you get out of it depends on what you put into it. And so that's what kind of stuck with me. And to me, getting away from Washington and going to Cape Town was putting me into an academic environment. I got to hang around with the professors. I got to meet all these students. The first year when I went, there were 14 or 15 of us first-year PhD students, the first colloquium I had to go.
Uh-huh.
There were four colloquiums a year. Year two, there were 30. And so you're meeting all these people, and by the end of the year, half of them have dropped out because life happens, and they just couldn't continue. But then the third year, there was about 20 or so. And so I just got to meet all these people, and so I really enjoyed going. And plus, again, I would sit through the same research colloquiums and the same lectures, and I'd hear the same things, but they would mean different things to me every time I heard them. And so I absolutely benefited by going all the time. So I just enjoyed doing it. I took personal leave. I paid for the whole thing myself. The government didn't pay for any of it. And it was inexpensive, by the way. Annual tuition is about $2,000, depending on the exchange rate.
Were you the only space cadet there, or did anybody else join in?
I was the only person in the space industry there.
So if you want to cut down on that 24-hour travel time when your furlough ends and you go back to the FAA, you might try to goose them to deal with Boom so that they can change the laws on supersonic transport, because they're making great progress on their supersonic plane.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So between Boom or between, you know...
There's another one, too. I forget the name. I'm familiar with Boom. I've been trying to get them on the show, but they won't come on.
Yeah.
But they've got to have laws conducive to even doing the testing of the plane.
Right, and so this gets to the institutional aspects of industry emergence, you know. It's not a question of technology. I mean, there's a great book called Stalemate in Technology. It's written by Gerhard, what's his name? I've got it here somewhere. He's an economist, and he wrote this book, Mensch, and he wrote this book called Stalemate in Technology, and he shows how in the electromechanical industry development in the early 1800s and then in the organic chemical industry in the later 1800s, from the time that there were scientific inventions or understanding of the concepts that were required to model and to understand these physical, you know, processes, from the time they understood it scientifically to the time they created a product, you know, to the time the innovation actually started happening, could be as long as 100 years. And it wasn't like they were waiting for some piece of the puzzle to fall into place before the innovation could start. It takes that long sometimes, not to conceive the innovation, but for society to warm up to the innovation. And this gets back to the legitimacy thing. For this to become taken for granted, to get the what they call cognitive legitimacy, to get that to a level where now it's going to be adopted, this innovation is going to be adopted, it just takes a long time, because we, the humans, and we, the society, are the quote-unquote weak link. We're the slowest part of the whole puzzle. So same thing here. I mean, the technologies for suborbital flight have been around for decades, but it's just people have got to get used to it. So you got to see it in movies. You've got to see it demonstrated. The prize programs have got to get companies to try to demonstrate it even before they might be ready to demonstrate it, and to get publicity so that people can see it and they can start becoming aware that it's possible. There's so many people, and a lot of people I was talking to in my classes, that have no idea about emerging commercial space industries, you know. So it's a big thing, and society has a major impact on how fast we can get these technologies up and running.
Well, absolutely, and you know, the SST is going to be an example of that, the commercial models of it. So,
right.
You know, that'd probably, you know, cut your trip to Cape Town down to like flying from New York to London.
That would be great. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, now I think an 8-hour trip is nothing, because 24 hours, you know, it's 8.5 hours to Dakar and then another 8.5 hours to Johannesburg and then a couple hour layover, then another 90 minutes to Cape Town. That was 22.5 hours once airplane to airplane, you know, getting on the airplane to getting off the final airplane. But I figured out a system to endure it, and if I had to go tomorrow, I would not shudder at all, because I really do love going to Cape Town. It's an amazing place, and just Google images of Table Mountain, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, I've been there, but I was there when apartheid was still going on.
That was an interesting experience. Part of the, you know, so when I was there, we talked to a lot of white South Africans, a lot of black South Africans, about academic, you know, colonialism is a big subject right there right now.
Uh-huh.
And so all the colonial aspects, it's really exciting because it's open, it's dynamic. I was actually on a morning show, Cape Town morning show. If you Google, I think it was called the Espresso Show, Cape Town. I was on there talking about commercial space because it was a big deal.
Good for you. They need to do more programs, and I don't think South Africa's ever had an astronaut or been involved in space, right?
Well, there's a guy named Mark Shuttleworth.
Well, but he's
like
over here now.
The station, so,
no,
yeah.
I mean, from over there, an astronaut, you know, that's living over there that goes up from another country.
No, I was just there, actually, back in October. They have the Royal Aeronautical Society branch in South Africa is called the Aeronautical Society of South Africa. So I was there for the conference that they have every year, and we got to go to their Denel test range, which is where they had planned a small satellite launcher site, and due to budget cuts and delays of construction and stuff, it ended up getting canceled. But they've got a nice little stretch of shoreline. And just on the, it's kind of, I think, on the east southeastern tip of Africa, the entire continent, that they could launch off of, and it would be really, really impressive. But right now they don't have that capability. But there's a lot of stuff going on in South Africa in terms of small sats, in terms of technologies. So they've got a vibrant industry at the, I would say, the subsystem level.
Jerry in Dallas, maybe it'll be the last question. We're actually coming up on a two-hour show. Says, surely the people are familiar with and have heard of Elon Musk, given his roots from there. What
right.
Do they, or did you find that he's not known over there?
Oh, he's absolutely known, and I guess he was absolutely known, and you know, they know him. I guess Elon has made it pretty clear about his understanding of, or his feelings toward the way he felt he was treated when he was over in South Africa. I guess he didn't have good experiences in his boarding school or something. So he doesn't go there often. He's made contributions to certain charities and certain organizations there, but he sort of doesn't spend a whole lot of time there. Elon obviously has been very active on the international stage. He went to Mexico and made a major announcement.
Right.
First announcement about the big Falcon rocket, and then a year later in Adelaide, he made a subsequent announcement in the International Astronautical Congress. But I think he doesn't do a lot of he doesn't get off the plane a lot in South Africa.
Anything that we should have talked about during the time we've been on the air that we've omitted or forgotten or should have known better to talk about or anything?
I don't know. I mean, we've covered a lot of stuff. I mean, what I think is interesting, you know, because I'm totally into this industry emergence stuff. It's just a totally different, it seems to be a different subject from the space stuff. The space folks kind of aren't really interested in, well, what is the phenomenon or what is the process by which industries emerge. They just want to, you know, they're just really focused on the space side, which, hey, listen, I'm there too. I'm very focused on that. But it sort of highlights this scholar practitioner or academic practitioner divide. There's a whole lot of research and a lot of discussion and angst that goes into how do we breach this divide. And there's a lot of work that there's a lot of requirements that we get put on ourselves as government employees. They say, you know, if you're doing research, you have to worry about tech transfer. How do you get this information out and get it to the people that can use it? And, of course, you know, NASA does NASA tech briefs, and they spend a lot of energy doing this. But the perennial observation is that it's not going as well as one would hope it would go. And so the two sides of my research, the phenomenological part, which is the process of industry emergence, and the industry context, which is the space industry, are kind of typify that divide where the practitioners are super interested in the space industry part, but they don't care about the process and the legitimacy and the mediators and moderators kind of thing. Whereas, you know, the academic part of me, and if I want to like get my research published in academic journals, I have to really focus on the non-space stuff. So there is this sort of dichotomy there, but I think both sides are interesting. So I'm just trying to, you know, spread the word that A, social sciences are not can be taken seriously. Qualitative research methods can be taken seriously, and you know, we kind of need to understand the underlying phenomenon so that we, as government employees and government policy influencers and decision makers, can make better decisions, make better policies, and try to coordinate our activities better so that we don't act at odds with each other.
Yeah, I run into that with the business school background and degrees too, on the qualitative side rather than quantitative side. So there's a lot of biases out there. I'm sure you've already found that.
No, and that's part of my crusade. I mean, it's qualitative methods have gotten much better, and they're just a lot harder to do this process research that I did. You really have to dig down deep, and I'm very lucky that I had news aggregators out there that I could rely on, and I was steeped in the industry. I probably have my own research bias built into my research because, you know, I've been doing this for so long. But you kind of need that depth of understanding and involvement to be able to really get all the nitty-gritty details together, because I don't know, you grab somebody who's never been involved with space and say, build this map, I don't know how well they do, because they don't know where to look half the time.
I didn't have news aggregators, and the Internet was not well developed, and I made friends with a librarian at something called the Linda Hall Research Library in Kansas City, who really took an interest in space, and she helped me find cutting-edge articles and then get abstracts and then get the articles that I wanted, and I had to buy them, and I was buying maybe 20 or 30 articles a month for close to a year in order to get cutting edge research, because the journals weren't printing things on space tourism and commercial space in the late 90s.
Yeah, no, that's
or anything
that's,
like, and I didn't have the internet.
It's amazing how important the research librarians are and the university librarians are. I absolutely leaned on mine at University of Cape Town and became really good friends with her.
Yeah, they're instrumental. And Berkeley, I joined the Berkeley Library, and they helped me a lot over across the bay at Cal. Interesting, like Stanford wasn't interested in helping, and San Francisco State wasn't interested. I did use their facilities, but I didn't get a lot of support. But Cal was great, and Linda Hall Library and AIAA were absolutely phenomenal.
No, that's absolutely fantastic. And I just enjoyed so much, you know, having my student status, because, number one, getting access to all the journals and whatnot, it's been absolutely fantastic. I totally am going to miss that when I lose it.
And yeah, I got that, too. That is a wonderful benefit.
It's amazing. And then, B, the EduRoam network. So there's something called EduRoam, EduRoam, and that's a wireless network that's, like, at every university. I had my EduRoam, and it's super fast, and you connect right away. I had my EduRoam ID from Cape Town. You know, that was active. I went to Ohio State University and opened up my laptop, and bang, it connected. And I was having phenomenal upload and download speeds because I was part of EduRoam. So that's absolutely almost worth the price of admission right there as well.
Can anyone join that, or do you have to be academic?
You have to be a student.
Too bad.
It's amazing. Amazing. It's everywhere, too.
Maybe I should go take a class at the community college.
If you can get EduRoam for taking a single class, you know, for a year, that totally would be worth it.
All right. Well, listen, keep us posted on your findings and your research and your publications, okay? And we'll make sure the audience stays up with you, too.
Will do. No, thank you very much, David. This has been a lot of fun. Sorry for talking so much. I know I do a little bit too much of that.
Not a problem. Glad to catch up with you. Congratulations again on your PhD. You actually got the PhD degree, not the DBA, correct?
That's right. No, I decided to go. You know, the big question was, why, when I get an MBA, why go get a PhD? And I absolutely wanted to do something that was deeper, you know, more academic, and I decided against a practitioner's degree and decided to go for a full-up PhD. So
okay. Well, keep us posted and send me links, and I'll keep the listeners posted on your research and your findings and your work. And hopefully the next time we'll talk, you'll be back at the FAA, and you can tell us about some of the programs and things that you're working on there and the new AST director.
Absolutely. There's a lot of fun things going on there, so I look forward to that discussion.
Okay. Thanks very much, and enjoy your paid vacation.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it. Come back on Sunday for our Open Lines program. We thank Ken Davidian for being with us today, for those of you who sent in emails. Everybody have a great weekend. Keep looking up and stay safe. Goodbye from Ken, David, and the Space Show.